Okay, folks, welcome to the latest edition, latest chapter, the latest exciting adventures from life on Planet Porky, with, of course, myself, the Porkmeister, and more importantly, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Miss Leslie Ann Jones. Miss Jones, how are we this fine day in the week of the May bank holiday?
It's upon us, isn't it? Mm. It's crazy how the year is racing by. I couldn't quite believe that we'd hit the 1st of May already and thought, where's the year going? It's evaporating.
Yeah, no, I feel a bit like that as well. Maybe it's because we're all outside again now, and for the previous 2 years we haven't been, you know, and life seems better and sweeter because you feel the air on your face, and now at this time of year the blossoms coming out and all that kind of stuff.
Are you calling me stiff?
No, I'm not calling you a stiff, Miss Jones. Miss Jones.
Miss Jones.
So maybe that's it. I don't know. So I always feel with bank holidays, I hope it's good weather. I don't like blazing sunshine, but I do feel that those who rely on their living for it, and I'm talking about people at the seaside or people who, you know, run outdoor activities, they rely on maybe, I don't know, half a dozen weekends a year to make all their money, if you see what I mean. And a bank holiday one is one of them. And I just hope it goes well for them.
But indeed.
The weather's been really inclement, hasn't it, lately? For the last week, I've been putting a coat on and I've been going out. And, you know, it's unusual for this time of year. But anyway, I'm not only...
Funny thing about Brits, though, you know. Yeah. I said this to my daughter a couple of days ago. One little glint of sunshine.
Yes.
And you get all these Brits out in shorts and strapless dresses.
Yes.
Sort of flaunting their tiny bit of fake sunburn and all the rest of it. And you see them standing around absolutely shivering because they haven't got enough clothes on.
Well,
but they're determined to make the most of the exposure to a bit of sunshine.
Yeah. No, I agree with you there. When I used to work in Newcastle upon Tyne, the girls there, even in winter, even, you know, in sort of December weeks, never wore coats. They just wore flimsy dresses. It was a sign of valour. And they did it all the time. Honestly, it was unbelievable.
You know, you see girls, sometimes they put pictures in the newspapers of a gaggle of young girls on a night out, all falling around drunk.
Yeah, face down.
And it'll be in the middle of winter, and they'll have bare legs right the way up to their bottoms.
Yes.
And these ridiculous, vertiginous shoes that they're usually carrying because they can't stand up in them.
That's right.
But they've got no coats on.
Yeah.
They've got these flimsy little bits of gossamer dresses on.
Yeah.
And you just think, what is this madness?
Oh, Miss Jones, you're starting to sound like an old maid. That's young girls having a good time on the town. You know, I'm glad they still do it because they did it in my day and it was a great deal of fun, honestly, to be able to offer a bit of warmth to a young lady who didn't have a coat. You know what I mean?
Yes, I know what you're getting at. Yes, I do sound like an old man.
As a gentleman, I mean, it's a very honourable thing. You know, here I used to offer girls my coat. That's how I used to get off with them. You know, they'd all be standing there. And, of course, they're immune from the cold because they've drunk so much, you know, the large vodkas and all that kind of stuff. So I'd always say, oh, no, you're cold. Here, take my coat. And they always thought I was terribly gallant because it was usually about -3. But I'd take my coat off, give it to them, wrap it round them. All of a sudden, I became the love of their life.
Oh, yeah. I bet. Well, you were the type who also threw your raincoat down over a puddle for a young lady to step across?
That never happened, actually. The Sir Walter Raleigh story. But I know what you mean. I think I would have done, perhaps, if I could have done. Talking about young women, or maybe not so young women, sort of terrible debate going on at the moment about women in Parliament, how it's all misogynistic and that dreadful MP guy, Neil Somebody from Devon, who's watching pornography in the Commons. I mean, I don't know if you've ever worked in the Commons, Miss Jones, but I have a bit. I used to work there as a political correspondent when I worked for the Birmingham Evening Mail in London, and I've been there many times, you know, to meet MPs and all that. And there is a very, very, very male feeling about the House of Commons, but surely women know that before they want to sign up and get in there. Mrs. Thatcher didn't do too badly, did she?
No, there was a bit of tokenism going on back then, wasn't there?
Yeah.
But surely we have got through that now. And a woman can be seen as just as capable of doing the job. Mm. I mean, let's not forget they all have their own constituencies and they all work incredibly hard in those situations to deal with their local problems. Mm. It's not just about sitting there in the House of Commons and doing what they do. I'm sure a lot of people currently think, what exactly are they there for?
Yes, no.
Because the focus is very much not on running the country right now, but it's on scandal and it's on sleaze. Mm. And of course, it all boils down to two things, drinking and sex, doesn't it? Yeah. In any situation in life.
Yeah.
And we've now got a House of Commons, we've got a parliament that is underpinned by those two things.
Yeah.
I'm not saying either of those two things is bad in the right context, but in the workplace, surely not.
Yeah, no, I agree. We've talked before about the difficulty women have always had walking into bars on their own, you know, because it's not seen as very ladylike and it's very intimidating for a woman, particularly if a woman's as good looking as you are, Miss Jones, because she knows she'll be stared at and whispered about and all that kind of stuff. Exactly the same atmosphere pervades in the House of Commons. I think there's about 12 bars altogether. I think the most famous one is the Strangers Bar, where the journalists drink in the Strangers Bar. And I've been in there loads of times. I've been invited over, you know, for dinner and we'll go to the Strangers first. There's never any women in there. So that in itself has to be a terrible barrier to, you know, the sort of social mixture, social banter that you have to get involved in.
And now we're hearing stories of young researchers getting so drunk in one of said bars that they are found vomiting in the corner and this kind of
thing. Yeah, sounds like Fleet Street.
Imagine if we'd have had bars in newspaper offices. Yeah.
Say again, imagine if what?
If we'd have had bars, you know, they have 12 bars in the House of Commons. Imagine if we'd have had bars in our newspaper offices.
Well, we virtually did at the Express, certainly.
Well, sort of, but they were outside. You had to go outside and go back in again.
Well, only just because in Fleet Street, it was, I forgot what it was called now. But
you had the Popinjay.
Popinjay, thank you. So you came out the main door of the Daily Express building, the iconic Black Lubyanka, and you turn left and you only walked 10 yards and then you turn left into the Popinjay, which was actually built into the fabric of the building. And then again, when we moved across to the new building just over Blackfriars Bridge on the other side of the River Thames, there was a bar there. But eventually it caused so much disruption to the working day that the new owner who came, I think it was Richard Desmond, had it closed down and turned into a gym.
Yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
I actually get that. But it's true. All the newspaper offices, I should say, all the pubs, all had their particular pub that you went to.
Yeah, they did, yeah.
Woe betide anybody who stepped over the threshold of the wrong pub.
Walked into the wrong pub, I totally agree. Talking about women in the workplace, right, I read this story, and it's not the first time I've read it, and I am just utterly bemused. Listen to this. A female prison governor exchanged intimate WhatsApps with an inmate after her marriage broke down, a court has heard. Victoria Lathwaite, 47, was jailed for 8 months at the Northampton Crown Court after admitting sending highly inappropriate messages to a 30-year-old prisoner who she was in charge of. I mean, what on earth goes through these women's heads?
Well, they're in the wrong job, obviously, aren't they? Surely it's rule number one on the contract when you take a job like that, that you do not fraternise with the prisoners because they are there to be protected, to protect the public from them, first and foremost, to protect them from themselves, because there's a lot of self-harm goes on in places like prison. Mm. But also, it's surely the same rules apply as apply to teachers in the classroom faced with 30 children.
Yeah, well, you think so.
You've got to stand back and not get involved.
Yeah, but they're not children. I honestly, I've read about these time and time again. There was one the week before about some woman who told her family, I think she was separated from her husband, but she told her parents and her children she was going to Florida to Disneyland, you know, with some friends. Instead, she flew to a prison in Florida and married some bloke who's serving life for a double murder. I mean, I just don't get it, honestly. Whatever's going on in their heads, they need treatment.
You've got a screw loose, haven't you? But it does happen all the time. This is a thing. I was, a while ago now, offered a writing residency in a prison.
Right.
And my job would have been to go in and teach creative writing to prisoners.
Yes.
And the deal was that you'd have a prison guard with you.
Right.
But you'd be in a room with, you know, 20 prisoners.
Yeah.
And as a woman.
Yeah.
And...
Was it a male prison, was it?
Yeah, it was.
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
And the thought of it still gives me nightmares because imagine anything could have happened,
yes.
Right?
Yeah, I totally agree. I just don't get it. I near where I live, there. I mean, further down into Surrey, about 5 miles. There's a prison, but sometimes I see the bus that takes the prison officers there pass by, and all these prison officers all look the same. You know, they got the dark uniform on and the heavy boots and all that kind of stuff. And I always think to myself, that's not a job I could do. Going into a place where human beings are locked up and, you know, all the angst and despair and, you know, horrors that go on there. I just couldn't work in that sort of environment. And that's why I think I've got an absolute terror of ever going to prison, which takes me on to one of the favourite sportsmen of my life, Boris Becker, who now is in prison.
Yeah, it's very upsetting, isn't it?
It's very upsetting. We talked about it before, but that was before he was sentenced. And, you know, he won't probably go to prison. The judge will probably give him a suspended sentence and all that. Oh, no, no. He's in pokey. 30-month sentence. He's going to serve about 15 months in prison.
The thing is, he did it, right? He's guilty. Yeah. He concealed properties. He put stuff in the names of his ex-wives, all to hide assets, which he didn't declare. Yeah. To his trustees in bankruptcy. Mm. And the bankruptcy rules are the rules.
Yes, I agree.
And you are warned in no uncertain terms that this is what will happen if you do that stuff.
Yeah.
And these people are very hot. They've got teams upon of people tracing you, checking you out.
Yeah.
He thought he was cleverer than the system and that he could beat the system. Mm. And I think they have to imprison him, having threatened to, because this also stands as a deterrent to anybody else who might be thinking of doing such a thing.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. There's no, look, I'm not defending him at all. What he did was wicked, actually, because he had up to £50 million of debt. And when you're declared bankrupt, whatever assets you have to be distributed to your creditors. So nobody's ever going to get 100p in the pound. We know that. But it could be 20 or it might even be 10. Do you see what I mean? But you have to give back what you've got left. And he hid it all. So he, you know, it's often said that, oh, you know, it's a victimless crime. It's not a victimless crime. You know, some people were owed money by Boris Johnson. He said he didn't have any, but he did have it and he didn't declare it. So legally, of course, he's got everything he deserved. And he's quite lucky not to have got a longer sentence. But nevertheless, when you think of the fall from grace, he's in a prison in Wandsworth, which is 2.1 miles from Wimbledon, from the centre court, where he won 3 Wimbledon titles and, people forget, lost another 4. He played in 7 Wimbledon titles. People also forget, in 1992, he was an Olympic gold medalist. He won the tennis gold medal. I mean, his achievements are just so breathtaking. And yet, I think he's like the other Boris. I think he can handle all the big things well. I think Boris Johnson can handle big things well, like elections and like Brexit, and Boris Becker can handle big things well, like winning the Olympic gold and winning Wimbledon championships. But the small things, i.e. day-to-day life, utterly hopeless.
Yeah, it's a massive fall from grace, isn't it?
Oh, shocking.
Look, in lots of ways, it is a shame, but how the mighty fall, it's a phrase that we hear so often. A friend of mine, who I better not say who it is, because she listens to this podcast, started a debate on Facebook about the fact that this is a white-collar crime and therefore shouldn't be punishable by imprisonment.
Yes.
And I was astonished by the reaction to this post. Mm. She really genuinely was saying that he doesn't deserve it because he's famous. Mm.
Yeah. Well, I have thought to myself, what's it going to be like for Boris in prison? What happens if the door of the cell opens and you're a prisoner inside, you're in a 2-bed cell, but there's only one of you in there. And all of a sudden the new prisoner's coming in to spend the next 3 months with you. And you see it's Boris Johnson. I mean, that can't be allowed to happen. Boris Becker. Freudian slip. Yeah. And all of a sudden you see it's Boris Becker. Well, that can't happen. That can't be allowed to happen, can it?
Well, it will happen because inside, it's like, in a way, inside the Groucho Club, you know, everybody's
yeah.
equal.
Yeah, I suppose you're right.
What happens in the Groucho stays in the Groucho.
I suppose you're right. Wandsworth is one of the oldest prisons. It's, you know, it's rat infested and all that. But I did read he'll be off to a Category C, which is a, like a sort of open prison, in a couple of weeks' time. But after that, I mean, sometimes you can rehabilitate yourself when you come out of prison. We know plenty of people who've done that. Jonathan Aitken. That's right, yeah. And
didn't he become a priest?
He still is. He's now a prison priest, if you see what I mean. He's a priest within the prison service, yeah. And he, you know, he must have genuinely had a, you know, an epiphany when he went in there, because he changed from being a vile, you know, sort of capitalist to I'm not saying all capitalists are vile, by the way. I like capitalists, but he was one who cheated to a priest. But when Boris comes out, I don't think he can do next year's Wimbledon. You see what I mean? Can he? I don't know. Will his reputation be so badly shredded that he can't do any public performances anymore?
If he's got any sense at all, he is currently on page 2 of his prison diary, and he's going to write his experience from inside, and he'll bank a load of money for publishing that when he gets out.
Yeah, well, he will, but that won't keep him forever, the rate he spends money. One of the problems he had was he paid $22,500 a month rental on a property in Wimbledon, very close to where he won his championships, for 20 years. And it's estimated that if he'd have got a mortgage and bought the place, he would have paid for it after 5 years. But he didn't. He wasted, I mean, millions of pounds paying rent. So, you know, once again, it's getting the little things wrong, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I wonder if his girlfriend will stick around. Do you think she'll wait for
him? I've no idea. Who can tell? And who can tell what's going to happen next, you know? But it was heartbreaking. Well, not heartbreaking, but to see him carry his Arab bag into court because he knew that he was going to jail that night, not too good. Now, talking about fashion styles and all that and hair, Miss Jones, did you ever used to get your hair done at Nicky Clark's salon? Because all the best people, and I put you in that bracket, Miss Jones, got their hair done at Nicky Clark's salon, which has now closed down because he says he can't afford to run it anymore.
Well, no, I never did, because I'm not stupid enough to pay £650 for a haircut.
That's a good point, yeah. So what was the attraction of having your hair done by Nicky Clark then, if anybody else could do it the same?
Do you know, hairdressing is one of those Emperor's New Clothes categories.
Right.
There's so much of a con attached to it.
I agree.
Not very many hairdressers are any good.
Yeah.
Not very many of them can transform you into a goddess or a god. If you start with thin hair and, you know, I don't know, skinny kind of scalp and all the rest of it, they can't perform miracles. It's all about publicity. Mm. And I met Nicky Clark a few times.
Yeah.
I went out for dinner once with his ex-wife, Leslie,
right.
who was a lovely person. Yeah. There was her, there was Joe Malone and another couple of people. We went out and had this girls' night out, absolutely fabulous.
Yeah.
And there was no doubt in my mind that Leslie Clark was the brains behind that business.
Right.
But it was all about projecting him.
Yes.
He's quite an ordinary, almost commonish sort of bloke, really.
Right.
But he had fabulous hair himself,
yes.
which was quite long,
yes.
and he didn't cut it very much.
Mm.
But, you know, I knew one or two people, especially a very good Japanese friend of mine who used to go to him to get her hair cut.
Yeah.
And then she stopped going because she said, 650 quid, it's just a bill too far.
Of course
you know,
it is. It's
no haircut is worth that. And she started going somewhere else and her hair looked just as good.
Yeah.
So I think it's all about publicity and projection. I'm not surprised he's closed down because the rents in Mayfair are ridiculous.
Yes, that's right.
He'll pop up somewhere else.
Yeah, no, I agree. No, I totally agree with that. It's all about where it is, the location geographically, the image, how much publicity has this place got, and then people queue up to get in there. Just have their, I totally agree. I don't know why. Talking about hair, there's a model or an actress called Jessica Gagan. Have you ever heard of her?
Yeah.
Yes.
Isn't she a beauty queen or something?
Yeah, that's right. Sorry, she is. I think she's going to be the first Miss England, but she's got what you might call auburn hair or ginger hair. And she says this will be a breakthrough for all women with auburn hair because it's never happened before. I love women with auburn hair. I really do, honestly. It's my favourite hair colour.
Well, they always used to say blonde, brunette or redhead, didn't they, in the old days?
I suppose so, yeah, that's right.
And I don't understand why we're still on that page of there's something wrong with having, well, we might as well say it, ginger hair. Yeah. What's wrong with that? Yeah. Ginger Spice did very well out of it, didn't
Certainly
she?
Certainly did. Prince Harry's done all right out of it. More of that later, folks. Yeah, but it's always been, I don't know, sort of, you're different, aren't you? Carrot Top, I was called at school, because I had very ginger hair when I was
Did you
kid.
Have ginger hair? I didn't
Oh,
know
very
that.
Ginger. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, if you saw pictures of me as a kid, I was like, a Carrot Top, actually. That's why I was called Carrot Top. One kid at school very unkindly called me Jaffa Cake. He said, you're Jaffa Cake because you're ginger on top and soft underneath. And I thought, well, that's a bit harsh, isn't it? But
And Angela Rayner's done okay out of it as well.
Well, Angela Rayner's just becoming a joke now. I mean, I just don't get it. You know, telling everybody else that they're lying and deceiving and got to be honest and all that. And then we find out that, well, actually, you seem to have been lying about your presence at the Durham Miners' Gala for the last year. Anyway, look, we've had enough of politics already in this podcast, Miss Jones, so we will move on. Now, we've got to have a Beatles story. I couldn't believe the images I saw of Paul McCartney on stage. I think it was in Washington, in America. He's playing a load of Beatles hits, but behind him on a massive screen is John Lennon from the Get Back videos, and he's playing in sync with him. Wasn't that amazing?
Well, they've made a big fuss about this, and it's absolutely fine and lovely. Of course it is. It's a gorgeous thing to see. It's quite moving, actually.
Yeah.
But it's not the first time Paul's done this.
Is that right?
I've been to many McCartney concerts, and of late, he is in the habit of projecting John on screen and does sing along with him. So it's something he's been perfecting for a while, I think.
Right.
But they've got it in sync, and he does appear to be singing a duet with John, which is very special.
God,
but
fantastic.
It's not the first time he's done
fantastic.
It.
Fantastic. Well, I've only ever seen one McCartney concert at the O2 in London. Paid £600 for a seat in the best box right next to the stage.
Did you love it?
Yeah. Oh, it was fantastic. It was absolutely great. But I don't remember there being any video, because I'd have remembered it, obviously. But he sung all his big hits. You know, he had the pipe band marched on for Mull of Kintyre, and he sang Get Back and Hey Jude. And, you know, it was worth it all for that, obviously. And very, very memorable night. So if I ever get the chance to see that sinking, it would be sensational, because the pictures of Lennon were so vivid and so alive. It was from the rooftop concert, wasn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely was. Because at one stage, the camera pans right back and you can see that John is wearing the fur coat and all the guys standing around on the roof around there.
Yes.
But have you seen the footage online? Because there's plenty of it out
there. No, I'm going to. As soon as we finish this, now that you reminded me, because I've had a busy few days, getting in late and getting up early and all that kind of stuff. I've become quite irritable, Miss Jones. But anyway, there you go. I shall...
Calm down, dear. Have some chamomile tea.
Yeah, that's a good idea, though. I'm thinking of doing that, actually. Tea does kind of soothe me, and I thought I'll get something like green tea or chamomile or something like that. Right, thank you everybody for listening to Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and of course, Ms. Leslie and Jones. Ms. Jones, I tell you who I've met recently, and I was thrilled to sit down and talk to her. I was in a TV studio doing some work, and suddenly she came in, and it's the Royal Authoress Angela Rayner. Now, have you...
Angela Levin, even.
Oh, Angela Levin. Isn't her name Angela Rayner?
No, Angela Rayner's the politician we were just talking
good
about.
Good God, I'm going mad. Because, actually, it's a good job I didn't make a fool of myself, because I walked up to her and I said, hello, I said, are you Angela? She said, oh, yes. And I said, hello, I'm Mike Parry. She said, oh, Mike, how nice to meet you. You know, I've heard so much about you. I thought that was very nice. But the reason I spoke to her was she's married to a guy called Rob Lowe. And Rob Lowe's an outstanding former Fleet Street journalist who went on to be editor of great institutions like Reader's Digest and all that kind of stuff. And I haven't seen Rob for years. So I said, look, if I give you my number, would you ask Rob if he... And she said, oh, I'm sure he will. I said, no. I said, he might not. I said, he's met lots of people over the years apart from me. And then lo and behold, I get a message from Rob Lowe. It was quite touching, actually, because it's about 20 years since we kind of saw each other. But anyway... that's aside, I spoke to Angela about the reason she was in the studio was her forthcoming book is coming out on Camilla, okay? As I think you probably know, do you?
Yeah, I used to work with Angela, actually. She was at U Magazine, the Mail on Sunday's colour supplement, right, at the same time as me.
Yeah.
And she had the Angela Levin interview. So each week, you know, she would interview some big name, and she had pride of place in the magazine. I always found her a bit tricky, to be honest.
Really?
Yes, a bit diva-ish, a bit demanding, but very good. She got what she went for, you know?
Well, funny you should say that, because whenever I've seen her on TV interviews, I mean, she just doesn't suffer some interviewers at all. You know what I mean? She can be very prickly towards them, and her responses and, you know, are you taking me seriously and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean?
But it's because of her image, I think. She's got this quite sort of safe, mumsy image, hasn't she?
Yeah.
With the little bubble hairdo and all of that. And you think you're getting a different type of person from the one who actually comes out. And she can be a bit daunting to begin with.
Well, you say that, but I spent about 5 minutes with her and we chatted, and I found her incredibly easygoing and warm, and, oh, I'll make sure Rob gets hold of you. Don't you worry. You know, so nice to see you and all that. But the main point of my story is the reason she's writing the Camilla book is because she is a royalist, you know, and she's... she's always called on, isn't she, as a royal expert to talk about Diana and all that kind of stuff. I think she knew some of Diana's friends quite well, probably through those interviews you've just told us about. Mm-hmm. But she's. I got the impression she's writing it because the Harry book that's coming out, she's been told on good authority a lot of that is going to be attacking Camilla, and that's when she decided that she actually likes Camilla and she's going to write a pro-Camilla book. So I think that's quite noble.
Yeah, it's also quite commercial.
Mm. Good. Well, that's why you write books, isn't it?
Of course, yes. But just to say that, you know, this is not an entirely magnanimous movie.
Yeah, sure.
Authors write books to make a living, of course. Yeah. And Camilla, yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting period, isn't it, this? I'm sort of the opinion that once Her Majesty leaves us, that's sort of it for me and the royals. I'm not at all interested in the rest of it.
Yeah, no, you said that before, and I understand the reason why. Talking about women of a certain age, Sheena Easton is 63. I have a lot of admiration for Sheena Easton, young Scottish girl who came up. I think she made a flurry of about 4 or 5 hits, bang, and then just disappeared off the scene, but didn't have a huge decline, didn't go Amy Winehouse style into, you know, dereliction or anything like that. I think she just came out, made the best of what she could, sold 20 million records, and then disappeared again.
Yeah, but she didn't disappear.
Did she?
No, she first appeared on, do you remember it, The Big Time, it was called, Pop Singer, and it was Britain's very first music reality TV show.
Oh.
And, she had a string of hits.
Yeah.
She recorded very famously We've Got Tonight with Kenny Rogers, which was a massive crossover hit.
Wow.
She then, where you think she might have disappeared, she moved to America.
Yeah.
And she did the Bond theme for Your Eyes Only. And she recorded with Prince, for example, and with lots of other artists.
Right.
And she made loads of albums and stuff. I saw her last. She was in the cast of 42nd Street in the West End.
Right, yeah.
And she's done a lot of theatre work and so on. Mm. But she made her career in America. So you may have thought she disappeared from the British pop chart.
Yeah, maybe.
But that's... really, why?
Maybe. On the same day, by the way, old Sandy Shaw, right? Sandy Shaw, on this day, 1967, notched up a third UK number one with Puppet on a String, which she then went on to use to win the Eurovision Song Contest. So that was a pretty successful, albeit short, career as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, she, for a girl from Dagenham who worked in a motor factory, and she was discovered by Adam Faith, who got her a contract to EMI, and three UK number ones.
Yeah.
Can you remember them?
Puppet on a String. I wonder if one day that you'll say that. Do you care if you say you love me madly? I'll gladly be there like a puppet on a string. How do I remember those words from all those years ago?
Very, very memorable. And written by the great songwriter Bill Martin.
Oh, bloody hell.
And Phil Coulter, And Bill Martin also wrote, also with Phil Coulter, I should say, Congratulations, which was a big hit for Cliff Richard.
Congratulations and Celebrations. That won the Eurovision Song Contest as well, didn't it?
Oh, did it come at number two?
I think it came second. Yeah.
And they also wrote, I'm sure you remember this one, Back Home.
Oh, of course I do. 1970, England football team in Mexico. Back home, they'll be watching and waiting when we are far away.
Something like that. Yeah. But, I mean, crazy years when football teams would record singles. Oh, I mean, imagine that happening now. Yeah. It just wouldn't happen, would
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. Well, funny enough, prior to us recording this this podcast, my team Everton had beaten Chelsea 1-0. Thank God. We were in terrible trouble. It was a Goodison.
Bit of a thrill for you, that,
oh,
wasn't it?
Oh, huge. Honestly, massive. I mean, so massive that I didn't touch my phone afterwards because I thought I'll just, you know, say things and boast about things that people will do me down for afterwards. So I was incredibly restrained. But as the cameras panned across the director's box, as they always do, there were legends there who, you know, in whose company I melt. Joe Royle, the centre forward for Everton in 1970. Peter Reid, who was the midfield general for us in our great team of the 80s. And Graham Sharp, who also played forward in that team. And Peter Reid and Graham Sharp played in the 80s team. When Everton was so good, they were invited to the Top of the Pop studios to record a record as they won the league championship. And I've still got it. And it goes, here we go, here we go, here we go. Everton are the best, we all know. And I you know, as soon as I saw their faces, it reminded me of that record and everything. Oh, honestly, great days. But there we go. But football can't half play with your passions, I tell you.
Seriously. Mm. Yep. I know.
Yeah, of course you did.
I did grow up in a footballing household.
Of course you did. Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. Did you read about the agent who died, Minola? I can never pronounce his name, but he's 54 years of age. He's super agent. He looks after Paul Pogba. He's died, but he's left a fortune, allegedly, of about 100 million quid. And he's an agent. He's not a footballer. I mean, that tells you something about where all the money is in football, doesn't it?
It tells me a lot about where football went wrong, to be honest.
Maybe, yeah, maybe, yeah.
When it became about big money and celebrity and publicity, yeah, and what kind of watches they wear, yes, what kind of cars they drive, yes, all of that. And when football became televised, mm, to the extent that it was no longer about getting out there and kicking a ball around, yeah, it was about broadcasting.
Well, that's where all the money came from, certainly. That's where all the money comes from now. Most clubs now could do without the gate money, you know, because the riches in broadcasting. Because, of course, the ambition globally, and this is why people keep trying to, you know, reinvent football and create European super leagues, is for everybody in China to spend, you know, $1 a week on football, and then there'd be 100 times more money in football than there is now. But it's just very, very big business. From football to royals, what do you make of this, Miss Jones? Netflix has binned the Duchess of Sussex's planned cartoon series. That's been announced a few hours before us starting to record this podcast. I mean, is their empire now beginning to implode? Have Netflix finally decided we don't think they're that bankable at all? Netflix have paid them $112 million and so far haven't had any return on that money, because even the documentary that they were filming when they came on their flying visit to see the Queen is nowhere near yet completed.
I wonder if they get the money back, Netflix. Well, but I was surprised to see Mail Online open with that story this morning.
Oh, really? Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, they've really got it in for the Duchess.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Honest. Yeah.
It's any sort of foot wrong, any indication that her popularity might be waning, they jump all over it.
Yeah.
And it's another nail in the coffin.
Yeah.
I think that hatred has to stop, and I think the bitterness has to calm down. Mm. Really, they live in America. They're off our hands. Mm. We don't care about them anymore, do we?
No, I agree with quite a lot of that now. I'm starting to get bored of them. However, excuse me, I do think that the relationship is starting to sort of balance up, and I think flaws are being found in, you know, what their act is all about. And the reason I say that is, of course, Piers interviewed President Trump, Donald Trump, and he made a reference to Harry. He said he's, you know, he thinks he's, and he used quite a crude expression about the way Meghan sort of dictates his life. You know, he thought Harry was the most put-on man in the world by his wife. But funny enough, within the last 48 hours, I've read Jonathan Dimbleby say that. Jonathan Dimbleby, who's a royal author, I think he wrote Prince Charles's main book, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Yeah, he actually said, I think Meghan leads Harry by the nose and I don't think he's really in control of his life. So there's a lot of criticism coming Harry's way these days rather than Meghan's.
There is, and I think everybody's forgetting what a minor royal Harry is.
Yeah.
He's never going to be king. I think that Meghan misunderstood the line of succession in this country.
Yeah, of course she did.
I think she thought that Harry was going to be in a powerful position in our royal family, and that he is also a spare. We've always known him as the spare to the heir.
Yes.
Even, God forbid, if something happens to William, Harry will not gain the throne.
Yeah.
And I think she believed that he would.
Well, I think she believed in her sort of, you know, she's got a huge ego because she's an actress in Hollywood and they have to have huge egos to use their elbows to get to the best roles. Although, with no disrespect to her as an actress, because at least she was an actress and thousands of wannabes never quite make it to the screen. But she had the show, whatever it was called, but it was never a top-rated show.
Suits.
Yeah, Suits.
It was called Suits, yeah. We'd never heard of it until she came in Harry's life, I should say.
No, exactly. And I think she thought that, you know, that alone, that sort of Hollywood stardom, would mean that when she joined the royal family, when they came out of, you know, the church service on wedding day at Windsor Chapel, that the way they would do it would be that she would lead the way because she was the most glamorous, she was the actress, and she was the new young bride in the royal family. So she assumed that the royal family worked in the same way as the publicity machine in Hollywood. You know, what's the hottest number? What's the hottest ticket? Oh, it's Meghan. Right, she will lead the way. And she was. I've read this somewhere. She was terribly put out when she was told, no, you walk behind Catherine. What? Yes, you will. Oh, well, how long does this go on for? Oh, it goes on forever. Because this is the royal family. We don't get promoted and relegated. It's the way it is.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in that. And her nose was out of joint, more or less from after the honeymoon, wasn't it?
Yes.
It was only a matter of time. I feel quite cross about it, really. Mm. That story with the Oprah Winfrey interview has just faded away. Yes. But some terrible allegations were made against the royal family and against us as a nation, which have just been allowed to subside and evaporate. Mm. And they really shouldn't have been because they were unfair.
Yeah, well, I totally agree. There was odd expression used, wasn't there? Recollections may vary, which I thought was a very dignified way of the royal family responding. Now, Miss Jones, tell me, do you believe there is life after 007? And the reason I ask you this, it's not a leading question, but Daniel Craig has had some terrible reviews for playing Macbeth in a production in America, but it's not a traditional Macbeth. It's a Macbeth which, I don't know why they do these things, has been set in the present day. I mean, how can you set Macbeth in the present day? Is it any wonder that Daniel Craig got completely bum reviews? And why did he do it in the first place anyway?
Well, you've just said it in your diatribe about Meghan. He's an actor.
Yeah.
You know, this is why they do it, because they have gigantic egos. Mm. He's never going to be more than 007. He's very, very lucky that he had such a long run. What did he do, 4 or 5?
No, 7, Bond I think, films? In the end.
Was it 7? I probably only saw the first few.
Yeah.
Five.
You know, could be right. I think you're right.
Yeah,
five.
People will argue with me about this, but I don't regard movie actors as proper actors, to be honest.
Yeah.
And I think that if they step out on a stage, that's when we see the measure of their worth.
Yes.
It's very easy with techniques of filming, stop, start, editing, all of that, to make somebody look incredibly good on screen, which is what he's always had. But there on a stage, you are bare. You have an audience in front of you live.
Right.
Who are forming opinions of you as you go.
Yes.
There's no opportunity to go back and do it again. There's no take five.
Yeah, you're right, yeah.
And lots of actors who've made their name on film or television cannot translate whatever skills they have to the open stage. Yeah. And I think that's what's happening here.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. He deserves all he gets, actually, because he was born and brought up in Ellesmere Port, okay? And Ellesmere Port is very close to my hometown, Chester. It's just down the A41. It's about 5 or 6 miles away. It's where Stanlow Oil Refinery is, which is the biggest oil refinery in Europe outside of Holland. He once took the entrance exam to my school, the King's School Chester, but he failed it. See, that, you know, people should have known then something was going to go wrong. I passed it, of course. I got in. I got through. I was a bright kid. I got all the O-levels and A-levels, but Daniel Craig didn't. So at some stage, he was always going to fail again in life.
Oh, that's very harsh, well, indeed.
You know, I'm sorry I have to tell you. Now, Ms. Jones, have you been to Portugal a lot?
Yeah, when I was a kid, I used to go there all the time because my father was very friendly with a man called Ernie Clay.
He owned
Fulham Football Club. That's right. Yeah. And so we used to go. He had a hotel in just outside Sintra in Portugal. Wow. We used to go there every summer.
Oh, that's great. Is that on the Algarve?
No. It's further up, say, not that far from Lisbon.
Oh, okay. So between Lisbon and Porto?
Porto's further up, right, isn't okay, it? Further north. Yeah. My dad used to play golf out there as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, amazing. The reason I ask is because apparently now Portugal is the only country in the world where the doors are wide open for us to go back. Portugal has become the first EU country since Brexit to allow UK visitors to be fast-tracked through electronic passport gates. So, you know, all the hassle of the paperwork and visas and all that, go to Portugal and you're clear. And Portugal, of course, are our oldest ally. Did you know that? In military terms, the oldest ally we've ever had is Portugal.
I don't think I did know that.
Yeah,
no.
They are. It's on the record. Goes back to the 1300s. And it's all to do with the capability of our navies in those days. Didn't have a navy in 1300, actually, but it's all about sea power. King Henry VIII created our navy. But no, the reason I bring that up is because we had some great times in Portugal as well. We used to go to the Albufeira on the Algarve, I think that was, you know, and delightful place, you know, lovely beaches. And it's where I first learned that I could eat and enjoy sardines, because that's all they've ever had to seem to have on offer in the cafes was sardines. Did you eat a lot of sardines there?
No, not really. No, our kids don't like things like that, do they?
I suppose not, no.
It was always steak and chips for us. I wouldn't eat steak now if you bribed me with it, Yeah, we always used to eat steak and chips every single night in the hotel. Yeah.
And we drank gallons and gallons and gallons of rosé wine, but it was called Blush.
Oh, yeah. And what was that Portuguese wine that was very popular in the 80s?
It was in a round bottle.
Yes, exactly what I was just going to say. Yeah. I can't remember the name of it.
I can't. But no, I like Portugal a lot. I had a job in Portugal once where I was sent out by the Express because this bloke who was a mad survivalist, you know what I mean? One of these kind of, and what's his name, a type guys.
Like a Wim Hof type.
Yeah, that's like a Wim Hof. And he's, as always, he's a former SAS guy. And he ran, you know, an outward bound training centre in Scotland where the army used to send these guys to harden them up and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? So this guy is so tough. He decides he's going to row across the Atlantic single-handed. He was the first guy ever to do it. I think his name was Tom McLean, because I remember he had the same surname as the author. It was Alistair McLean, wasn't he? I think so. So anyway, this guy sets off from Cape Cod or somewhere like that. And, you know, about 6 weeks later, he's getting close to Cornwall, which is his destination. But unfortunately, he got blown off course and he's now heading south to Portugal. So we brought up the family. When I say the family, brought up his wife and his horrible little kid, you know, who was a brat. And I had to look after them.
That's not very nice.
Well, he was. He was a brat. And as soon as he started drifting south, the office said, well, you'll have to follow him. So we had to get flights down to Lisbon, I think, yeah. And then when we got there, we sort of picked him up on his tracker and we thought, oh, here he comes. But then the wind changed and he was heading for Porto instead. So then I had to hire a Mercedes car and I drove from Lisbon to Porto 4 times in almost the same day as he changed directions, the wind changed direction. And the kid, the brat, would keep climbing on my head from the back seat because his mother didn't keep him under control, you know. and it was a nightmare, an utter nightmare. And eventually he landed and we found him. And honestly, have you ever had one of those jobs when you just wish you were anywhere but there?
Yeah, like the Hugh Grant story in Los Angeles, where we were the ones to get Divine Brown.
Yes, yes.
And had her holed up in a hotel in Palm Springs.
Right.
And managed to beat the competition on every single side.
Brilliant.
And then Stuart White, best West Coast reporter ever,
yes.
Who was
News of the World.
Man out. Yes, our man on the West Coast, as it were.
Yeah.
Who had a mate at British Airways who got me a seat on the return flight that Hugh was boarding, and my seat was next to his.
Fantastic.
So I get on the plane first. Hugh Grant comes on the plane, obviously in first class.
Yeah.
He puts his bag in the overhead locker, sits down, buckles up, sort of looks at me in the window seat and suddenly realizes who I was. And you've never seen anybody scarper off a plane so quickly.
Well, he got off the plane. He didn't just go and try and find another seat, no?
No, he got off the
plane. Well, at that stage, had he been charged by the Los Angeles police?
Yeah, he was on bail.
Oh,
and
right.
So he was going home.
Right, right. Oh, blimey. God, blimey.
So, yeah, that was a moment of shame, really. There's nothing I could have done about it. At least I got the seat next to him.
So the only story you had to write when you got back was Hugh Grant fleeing, yeah?
Exactly.
Good God.
It wasn't quite what we'd paid £3,500 for.
No, exactly. My God. What was your decision about chasing him off the plane?
I just didn't get a chance to. And also the stewardesses weren't going to let me.
Really? What?
You know, I because I was rumbled. I wasn't, a private first-class passenger.
Yeah.
I was rumbled as a journalist.
They couldn't stop you getting off that plane if you'd have said,
well,
get out of my way.
They actually did. They did stop me getting off the plane. He got off by the skin of his teeth.
Right.
Because he only got on at the very last minute.
Of course, I see. Yeah, yeah, I understand. Yeah, and then got off. Wow. Well,
see, had I tried to get off, they would have wanted, well, they would have had to get my luggage off. They couldn't have taken off with my suitcase in the hold.
Yeah. Of course.
So that would have delayed the flight, would have cost the airline a fortune.
Yeah,
so they made sure I didn't get
off.
Yeah,
you're right, yeah. Oh, blimey. And I bet your heart was so heavy on the flight home because, of course, you were flying all the way from California, one of the longest, well, it's the longest transatlantic flight, isn't it? And, of course, your mission had blown up in your face, yeah?
Yeah, I was empty-handed.
Oh,
and,
dear me.
It didn't go well, that one.
Yeah, but a great story, nevertheless. Right, OK, folks, that's it for another Planet Porky. On behalf of myself, I hope you're all going to have a great bank holiday week, so to speak. Is there another bank holiday at the end of this month, Miss Jones?
Yeah, there's always one at the beginning, one at the end of May. And then normally we don't get another one until August. But this year we've got Her Majesty's Platinum Jubilee.
In June, yeah. So there
in
we go.
June, yeah.
OK, well, good luck to everybody. OK, folks, see you again next week. Miss Jones, thank you very much indeed. And until we meet again. I'm glad they still do it because they did it in my day and it was a great deal of fun, honestly, to be able to offer a bit of warmth to a young lady who didn't have a coat. You know what I mean?
Yes, I know what you're getting at. Yes, I do sound like an old
man. As a gentleman, I mean, it's a very honourable thing. You know, here I used to offer girls my coat. That's how I used to get off with them. You know, they'd all be standing there. And, of course, they're immune from the cold because they've drunk so much. You know, the large vodkas and all that kind of stuff. So I'd always say, oh, no, you're cold. Here, take my coat. And they always thought I was terribly gallant because it was usually about -3. But I'd take my coat off, give it to them, wrap it round them. All of a sudden, I became the love of their life.
Oh, yeah. I bet. Well, you were the type who also threw your raincoat down over a puddle for a young lady to step across.
That never happened, actually. The Sir Walter Raleigh story. But I know what you mean. I think I would have done, perhaps, if I could have done. Miss Jones, I tell you who I've met recently, and I was thrilled to sit down and talk to her. I was in a TV studio doing some work, and suddenly she came in, and it's the royal authoress Angela Rayner. Now, have you...
Angela Levin, even.
Oh, Angela Levin. Isn't her name Angela Rayner?
No, Angela Rayner's the politician we were just talking
good
about.
Good God, I'm going mad. Here we go, here we go, here we go. Everton are the best, we all know.